Today's episode is brought to you by Slayhouse Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Hi, everybody. This is Slayhouse Publishing presents Lit Bits, and this is Jeremy. With me, as always, is Trevor.
Hey there.
And Curtis, who's actually not technically with me right at the moment. He stepped out of the room. I should wait and introduce him when he comes back in the room. And today we are joined by Michael Kellemeyer, who is you're the editor, the illustrator, the owner of Old Style Tales. You wear a lot of hats.
Like I do, yes.
Yes. So thank you so much for being on the show with us today. We can edit this out later. I'll do like our little snappy things so that we know to edit, but
sure.
We don't record live. I don't know if I ever told you that. So we'll have,
I mean, we do record
definitely
live,
good but to know.
We
don't post.
It.
Yeah. We don't release live. Yeah.
We produce it in post.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So, could you walk us through just a little bit of your background and how you got into, Old Style Tales as a press? It's Old Style Tales.
Yeah. Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So I started Old Style Tales in 2013. I think the idea came to me earlier that previous fall in 2012. I was a graduate student at Ball State University, wrapping up my master's in English literature. And, you know, I had the next step of, becoming an English professor. That was something that I was working on. I would go on to get an adjunct position later. I think it was that June of 2013. But I had this period of time in between then, from like December to June, where things didn't completely fall together. My wife will be the first to point out. She's my girlfriend at the time. And she was like, you know, you need to be applying to places. And I am the kind of person who was a little nervous because I didn't have my degree settled yet. And I was like, I don't want to apply to places. And then things fall through and I don't have a degree yet. So of course, I had no trouble getting the position at this community college in Southern Indiana. But I had this gap of about 6 months where I didn't have anything, at least career-wise, you know, on my plate. And so I had this time on my hands. And towards the end of my graduate studies, you know, I started to kind of refine what it was that I was really interested in. I think earlier, you know, as when you go into graduate school, a lot of times, you know, you have a tendency to be a little bit more pretentious and, you know, up here, I suppose where you guys are too, you might call it highfalutin, where you're just like, you're looking at things a little bit more as far as what would other people be interested in or what would like make me sound better, you know. But as I got close to the end of my degree, I was like, you know what? I love horror. I love classic horror. I love weird fiction. Ghost stories especially are really my bread and butter. And one thing that I had always noticed was I loved in grad school when we get critical editions of like Shakespeare or Milton or Ernest Hemingway. You know, I just love the footnotes. I love the introductions. I love the like, oh, okay, that was confusing, but you know, when this footnote clarifies it, I'm tracking. I'm more up to speed. And so, you know, I always hated that when you get the types of like classic horror fiction anthologies that are a little bit more popular, and I'm not disparaging them. I'm not, putting them down, but usually it's like a 4-page introduction that's basically cribbed from the author's Wikipedia page, just as far as like their biography, but almost nothing about the actual work. And that's it. And then a bunch of, you know, copy pasted stories. And so I was like, hey, I've got this time on my hands. And my idea was I was going to do 4 books. I can't remember all 4 of them, but I think I've only done 1. I was going to do Victorian horror stories, Edwardian horror stories, and then a couple of other, I think, anthologies of different authors. And I started with the Victorian horror stories. This is the very first book I did. And I just wanted to put some context, define confusing terms. One thing I always was annoyed with was whenever they talked about money, you know, I'd be like, okay, sure, that's great. That costs 3 shillings. What's that actually mean? Because not only is that not even a currency anymore, you know, but it's a different time period and it's a different country. And so just stuff like that, like making it make more sense. And so I put together my favorite Victorian ghost stories. And then I didn't move on to the Edwardian ones because I was like, well, what about, you know, Frankenstein? What about Edgar Allan Poe? And so I just, you know, started doing those. And to kind of wrap up this part of the question, you know, I did get that job as an adjunct professor, but kind of notoriously, adjuncts don't get a lot of work.
You don't
or
say.
Pay. Yep. And so though I had a job, I actually had a lot of time on my hands. And so I would crack out, you know, I'd keep cracking out books, and it got more and more ambitious as I went along. Cause again, it was like, I just want to do 4 books. And then at this point, I think I've got 35 in print.
Yeah, so it's a lot.
Do a year when I have the time.
That's awesome. I think what's really interesting about that approach is, you know, we're readers of fiction, like a lot of fiction. We're constantly reading. And we've thought a lot about, you know, these old tales too, because I think a lot of them are readily accessible with the internet. You know, they're all in the public domain, and yet reading them can be difficult. As a world lit instructor, you know, I run into kids all the time who just, you know, they struggle with like the most modern edition of Beowulf or the most modern edition of Gilgamesh, and trying to get them to read Victorian horror or read horror from the turn of the century is really difficult because, you know, it was a very different world. The concerns were very different. The language used to kind of obscure some of that meaning is very different. And so a lot of kids struggle with that, especially in an age when I think most of our communication is just like text messaging, you know?
Yeah.
How much actual reading is your average teenager doing, or your average 20 something doing, you know? So I think that trying to revitalize some interest in some of these old stories by contextualizing it is really an important, you know, literary mission, I would even say.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. And that was one of the things that immediately I wanted to do and that I was inspired by, was because as a grad student, I was also a graduate assistant. So, you know, I was 1 year out of my undergrad, and here I was teaching students who are like maybe 3 years younger than me. And so immediately, and you know, as a person who loves literature, you know, your circle of friends is going to be a little bit you know, homogenous, and you're going to have really similar passions, and even, you know, the people who weren't English majors, which honestly most of my friends weren't English majors, but you know, they were in different fields of study that gelled well with the idea of like, hey, like, let's get together and talk about this, you know, this nonfiction book or this fiction book that's, you know, 100, 200 years old, and just talk about ideas. But I quickly realized that there were a lot of really smart, potential-laden students out there who didn't have that same passion. Mm. And the thing that was holding them back was they didn't get, like, some of the they didn't get the stuff that if you're exposed to at an early age, you take for granted. And you're just like, well, yeah, everyone knows that. No, they don't, you know, and it's not a shame on them for not understanding that because they're not exposed to it. And so if you can remove some of those barriers, it's going to make it a lot easier for people to get into it. And so, yeah, that was definitely one of the very first things that I wanted to do is I want these stories to stay in the public consciousness. I want people to keep reading them and be inspired by them. And I don't think it is, again, I don't think it's highfalutin to try to promote Blackwood or Mackin or, you know, even Poe or Hawthorne. Like, these are still writers who they present a worldview that can push back on our own, especially our comfort, you know, and that can be both in the sense of like what we should be comfortable with, but also things that like we might be too comfortable with, you know, like the kind of philosophical ideas that we tend to be able to avoid. because of the 21st century, you know, and like because of cell phones and stuff like that. And so I think it's really useful. This isn't just like, well, it's a cute thing that can entertain you on a boring day. Like, it's more than that. These stories, they have genuine cultural merit. And so I want them to be out there for people who don't have English majors to enjoy.
Yeah.
I think that was, you know, kind of part of my follow-up is when we think about these stories, I think too, you know, we're so conscious of the current moment, right? You know, especially if you're, I don't know, even a millennial, a Gen Zer, you know, on the internet constantly, I think that you're constantly just inundated with like the feeling of now. There are conversations that crop up in social media spheres and it feels like they're here for a hot second. And then, you know, just a week or 2 weeks removed, nobody's, you know, talking about it anymore. Nobody remembers it. And so, you know, when looking at, I think the literature that you're talking about, where we are literally in some cases more than a century removed, how do we continue to find the relevance in these stories, right? Like, how is it that that we continue to see these stories and maybe see them not just with an eye for what happened over a century ago, but for you know, with an eye of
how they still relate today
now, right?
So that's such a great question, and I think one of the things that's interesting is one of the big answers to that is couched in that question, or at least in the lead up that you had to that. And it's the idea that I think right now we are very present minded and we are very, we're driven by what's fashionable or what's trendy. And I don't mean that in a demeaning way, but it is true. Like the thing that is like literally quote unquote trending, that's what we're drawn to. And art in the present moment can still be deeply universal. But I think a lot of times we're driven to things that's like, well, this is, you know, oh, ripped out of the headlines, you know, or this is speaking to a theme or an idea which might be universal, but that it also might just be like trending. It might be something that we want to talk about now, but then in 10 years, maybe it's lost a little bit of its polish. And I think what makes good classic fiction, and that's the key piece of this, is it has to be good. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's good. But if it is classic fiction, the reason it's classic is because it is dealing with universal human issues. And these are things that are absolutely timeless. You know, I mean, especially in the ghost story, we are talking about guilt. We're talking about sin, and not necessarily in a religious sense, but just the idea of like doing a horrible thing to another human being and having that lurk in your conscience. And we're talking about redemption, justice, which especially in the Victorian ghost story, justice is it's in almost every ghost story. Almost every ghost story is about the pursuit of justice, and because something has been broken in the living world, which can only be alleviated by something supernatural, because the living world is so broken itself and so unjust. And that's the whole point of these ghost stories, is it points out like you can't, especially the one that really comes to my mind is there's a story called To Be Taken with a Grain of Salt by Charles Dickens. It's also called The Trial for Murder. And it used to be like a extremely famous ghost story. It's fallen out of fashion recently. Well, not recently, but you know, it's since probably the 50s. But it used to be like in every anthology. And the thing with this story is it's about a murder, and the ghost has to attend the murder to kind of like prod the jury and point out fraud and point out injustices, and the lawyer's lying and the witnesses are lying, and he has to kind of like poke this one juror. And he just pours all this energy into motivating this juror to convict his murderer. And you know, the story, I don't think a lot of people read it and see this about, I think usually they kind of like some of the gory details. But the thing that's always stood out to me is if this ghost isn't like working 24/7 to try to convict his murderer, that guy goes off scot-free. And so a lot of these stories are about universal themes that it doesn't matter if it's a decade or it's a century, we're still really drawn to them. And and that's the thing that I think makes good fiction good and makes it worth revisiting, even when it's not something that we can necessarily relate to culturally.
I want to come back to this idea of like relatability to the current moment and cultural stuff, but I also want to, you know, just double back really quick to talk a little bit about that concept of like breaking down the barrier to entry for a lot of this stuff, right? So the way that you package your books, you include both annotations but also illustrations. And the illustrations I think are really interestingly made. They almost look like they're almost like woodblock etchings or you know, something like that. Can you talk a little bit about your process for illustration and how that also can contribute to breaking down barriers to entry?
Yeah, absolutely. I have kind of a funny story of how that even started. With my first book, The Victorian Ghost Story, I love pencil drawings. That's my favorite medium of illustration. And so I started just drawing white piece of paper, you know, pencil, making black marks. And for some of the stories, like, it was pretty easy, but I quickly realized if I'm going to do this genre, most of the best scenes take place at night, and that's a lot of shading. And so I always like the look of like scratchboard, which is what most people think my art is. They primarily think it's scratchboard. But I'm also I recognize pretty quickly also that scratchboard isn't as forgiving and flexible. And so what I do is I still take a white piece of paper and a pencil, make black marks on it, but I draw it in negative. And so if I'm drawing a moon, I just, you know, make a black ball, kind of use my finger to like shade it and give it a sense of dimension. Then I scan that, I invert the colors, and then I touch it up with software to make it a little cleaner. But so essentially what you're seeing is a negative of the picture that I actually drew. And I've always liked that look because there's still, even though it is a negative of a positive picture, there's something that's a little bit off about it. Like you get the sense of like, you know, it's a little off-putting because you're not seeing a lot of there's a lot that's left out, you know, because the focus is on light sources and what the light is hitting, and so it leaves an awful lot out. And I always like that approach. So as far as like making, oh my gosh, like it's a great question about how this makes it accessible. I'm a visual person. I really love illustrations. When I was a kid, I always collected those. I don't know if you remember the Great Illustrated Classics.
Yeah,
these small hardcover books that you could get at like a Dollar General for like $3 or $4. And they had an illustration on every page of like Ivanhoe and Moby Dick, and it just made it so like you got it better.
Yeah.
You know, and I was getting those when I was in first grade, and I just remember I didn't read most of the words, but I got what was going on because of the illustrations. Yeah. That's another thing that I just always hated about critical editions, you know, that you would get in college, is I think they, and I don't want to cast aspersions. I don't know what they're actually thinking, but I felt like they didn't include illustrations because it was like, well, we're above that. We don't need illustrations. You can figure it out by reading, you know? And I just loved, like, especially, you know, some of these short stories that I anthologized, like in the Victorian Ghost Story anthology, almost none of them have ever been illustrated. Now, some of the more popular ones have, but like, you know, some of my favorites, you know, I would look online just to see what's been done, you know, out of curiosity. And most of them had never even been illustrated. And I felt like that was a shame. But I think a person gets one of these books, they do have those introductions and analyses to kind of like help them walk them through almost in a conversational style about, hey, what's going on? Some of the stories have footnotes. You know, in the Victorian Ghost Story, it's fully annotated. Others, I will only annotate like the ones that have tons of references and tons of critical attention, but one way or another they have someone talking to them. And then there's also an illustration that can help them, you know, formalize or visualize a picture of what's going on. Who am I talking about? You know, what do these characters look like? And obviously that's my interpretation. But when you see someone else's interpretation, you can also kind of be like, I picture that guy a little bit more heavy set, or, you know, I wouldn't have put it that way. And that also helps, you know, engender an intellectual creative reaction to the piece.
That's a really great way of phrasing it.
And by the way, we've got it like right here.
Yeah, I saw that. Thank you.
For me, I've got to throw in there. For me, as a kid, it was the scary stories to tell in the dark.
I have that right by me.
Yeah.
I loved those illustrations, and I mean, everyone did. And I remember when they redid them in, like, I think 2010 or 2012.
Oh yeah.
And honestly, the illustrations looked beautiful, but everyone was pissed about it because they were like, oh my gosh, no, you can't touch those.
How do you retouch a classic? We must be about the same age, because I had all of those great classics illustrated books that you mentioned. I'm almost wondering if was that just like a late 80s, early 90s kid thing, you know?
I think it had to be. Yeah, I was born in 87. So,
hey, we are the same age, the exact same age. That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. I mean,
I'm older than you guys, and I still have those kind of editions. So I think they're around for.
I mean, to this day, I probably never would have read Gulliver's Travels if not for.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
It's so helpful. It makes it accessible. And I'm all about just making literature not something that is. That's like corralled over here for people who are, you know, quote unquote, smart enough to get it. I think it needs to be something that's offered up to, you know, anyone who's even remotely curious, and all those barriers, you know, as you mentioned, it's a major theme in my books. I really want to remove those barriers and make it something that people can feel like, hey, this is something I have a shot at grasping, even if it's a challenge. And I mean, that's one thing too. We can't deny that these stories can be challenging. I will argue that a lot of them are less challenging than people might assume, but some of them, they are challenging. Some of them are long. Some of them have big words, you know, and that can be a barrier, but it's a challenge that's worth, you know, taking on.
Yeah. Yeah. I take the same approach when teaching world literature. I think that, you know, part of the process of reading anything is just exposing yourself to it, you know, just being game to tackle it. And knowing that you do not have to walk away being an expert in any of this stuff, right? That's not the point. The point though, is that you interact with it in good faith and with good effort. Yeah. So every semester I teach one of my world lit classes, I usually include something I've never encountered before, something that I truly just don't know anything about. Yeah. And I tell my students, you know, when we get to it, I say, you know, this is the first time that I'm coming into this, you know, just like you. And I'm going to model the process for you that I go through, you know, to read this stuff, to think critically about it, and try to come away, you know, with some answers about what this really represents, what this is.
Yeah.
And I think that, I find year in and year out that when you break down those barriers to entry, right, when you make it a safe space to just encounter something, people usually end up much more interested and much more invested in it than, you know, they ever may have thought themselves to be, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's kind of circle back to just talking about some of the relevance of these stories and also thinking through like the contextualization of these stories and how relevant that contextualization is. I think when we read some of these stories that are, you know, a century plus old, they come from a very different social, economic, political background. And may have some ideas that maybe aren't so palatable to you know, the current moment. For example, we do encounter a lot of stories with like a lot of sexism, or you know, stories with a lot of racism. How do we, in your opinion, you know, what is our duty to try to contextualize these stories, you know, in their political moments. And, you know, does that excuse the racism, or is it something that you feel like we still need to grapple with in, you know, today's moment?
Yeah, definitely. I love that you start with that word excuse, because that was just on the tip of my tongue. You know, we really have a responsibility not to excuse it, or to say in terms of like justifying it, that it was a different time. I think it's critical to note that it was a different time, though. And that's, again, I think there's a difference in excusing something, contextualizing it. Just so that, you know, especially from the perspective of a, you know, a person who is a teaching in class, for instance, or as someone who's, you know, selling a book to a stranger, you know, I don't want people looking at and saying, hey, this is okay. Or, you know, it, for some people, this is okay. It's a relative thing, you know? So it has to be contextualized, and it has to be something that we understand going into it. And it's just such a great way also just to start those conversations, you know, why was this considered okay? And why don't we think it's okay? And that's the whole point of great literature. I also think about, I wish I could remember her name. I think it was Pamela Paul, wrote a piece for the New York Times. I think it was a few years ago, maybe 2017. She wrote a piece for the New York Times that was called Why You Should Read Books You Hate. And it's all about how reading books with strong ideas, regardless of whether you agree with them or not, is really healthy for your intellect. That there's, you know, there's research that shows that strong ideas in books, whether they're things that we say like, I believe everything I read, and, you know, if I read a book with racism is it in it, I'm going to become a racist, you know, that's not the approach that we want to take. We want to say, hey, if there's a strong idea about the human condition, and you read that, your response to that's your, you know, that's your responsibility. And reading a book with a strong idea that you disagree with, you know, that's something that can really edify you and help you to understand yourself and your values and your ethics better. And hopefully also, you know, there's definitely sexism, racism, but there's also just less offensive things that we might buck against. You know, things that are maybe more philosophical, or things that are more ethical or political, you know, that you read in a book and you just might be like, you know, the way that that character responded to this, or the way that the writer presented this, you know, makes me feel kind of uncomfortable. That can be a great way to deepen your understanding of yourself and the universe that you want to be a part of.
So kind of an approach of like, you know, look critically at this stuff, right? You know, don't just kind of ingest it, but you know, like really grapple with it. And through that process, you know, maybe we can learn a bit more about ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important, especially I think in this current moment, we're vacillating between different extremes of how do you respond to things that are offensive. And I completely understand and respect an approach that's like, you know, just put it all in the dustbin of history. And for sure, there are stories and there are even authors that their stuff is just, it's not worth reading because it's heinous. You know, and I'm not one who would say, you know, burn the books then, but I would say, I'm not going to waste my time reading that because it's garbage. But I think we have a really difficult, there's something that's not really good about a society that says, if I don't agree with it, I don't even encounter it. And I'd encourage people, you know, check out stuff that you disagree with or that makes you uncomfortable.
I think that's it's a tough thing to do. And I worry about this frequently, you know, as I encounter older stuff. I read a story the other day, about a dude with ghost arms. I wish I remember the title of the story. It was a guy who had his arms cut off by like an African tribe or something like that. And then, you know, ran through the rest of his life with ghost arms doing the work for him. And for one thing, I felt really upset about the story having been reproduced because it did have a kind of like British imperialist racism mm-hmm. attached to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of frequently wonder as I encounter these things that are reproduced in different spaces, you know,
mm-hmm.
Are we reproducing the best stuff? You know, like,
right.
What about this story, you know, meant that it deserved reproduction?
Exactly,
and was
yeah.
there something in there, you know, that did I miss something or was mm-hmm. this stupid story, you know, just kind of like, it was pretty dumb and also, you know, I like kind of unpalatably racist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is our duty when we, you know, come to these things, you know, whether to forget or to reproduce and yeah. talk about, you know, I think it's a tough line.
Well, for me, I mean, the author that jumps out at in this kind of conversation automatically is like H.P. Lovecraft and his overt like racism in his stories. But it wasn't until mm-hmm. I read Mikhail Ulebeck's, I think I'm saying that name correctly. I don't know. It's French. So we all, I mean, anybody mm-hmm. who knows me knows my abhorrence to French, my difficulties with it. I think it was a creative writing class, kind of a quick aside that I first started teaching a creative writing class, and like I get to the story structure part of the class and I'm like, so kids, this, you know, you get to the climax and then after that you have the denouement, and they're like, the what? And I'm like, oh wait, that's French. It's pronounced denouement, but it's like, okay. So, Mikhail Ulebeck wrote this biography of Lovecraft called Against the World, Against Life. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And it really details his, not just his, who he was as a person, but also kind of his racism and his, yeah. his worldview. And I think getting that kind of story about the author so that I could understand kind of where these stories are coming from, I think helped me yeah. kind of contextualize yeah. the importance of them and exactly how to process them in today's world.
It's such a difficult line to tread, you know, trying to mm-hmm. determine like the importance of this thing, you know, the importance of this story, like with Lovecraft, who has been so mm-hmm. influential in an entire genre of horror.
Because
right.
he's almost yes. one to me, like you were saying, that could be canceled. I mean, we could totally just quit reading him. But there is, I think, important.
It's real. Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, you look at just how overtly racist he was and how entrenched he is mm. in the community, in the horror community. You even think about like Lovecraft Country and how that's an overtly yep. anti-racist
yeah.
series that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Lovecraft. The title of the book that you mentioned, I haven't read it, but just Against the World, Against Life.
I'm pretty sure that was the title. I think it was
such a good, whether it's the real title or not, such a good way to describe him.
Yeah.
And it really hits on issues that I have with Lovecraft because, you know, I really enjoy his mood and his twists and his perspective, yeah. but I'm not a cynical person as much as I love, you know, weird fiction or, I'm a pretty idealistic person, and his stories a lot, just the way that they're very misanthropic, and they're very, they hate on human beings a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, it reminds me of that New York Times article, with the basic thesis of, you know, strong ideas, are worth contending with. Now, obviously there's some extremely strong, extremely not cool ideas that you shouldn't contend with, but just the idea of like, you know, how do we view humanity and how do we view ourselves? Is there innate worth to humanity? These are things that are worth talking about because if we don't talk about them, other people will. And those people, you know, if we just say, well, we're not even going to go there, these questions bubble up in the human consciousness, and it's important for us to have conversations about them so that they don't get repurposed by people with, you know, with very nasty, violent approaches, you know, to how we answer that question.
Yeah. His nihilism would really be the thing that I would want to, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, definitely he's one that it's kind of surprising that he hasn't been canceled yet, but But yeah, I think it's important. There's three criteria I have when I'm putting an anthology together, as far as like whether this makes it or not. And one is there a critical conversation around it? Like, is it big enough that in that literary sphere, people, you mentioned the title and people are like, oh, I have an opinion about this.
Right.
One way or the other, is if there's a critical conversation about it, then it's probably worth considering. The other is it creative? Is the world that it's presenting, is it a good, are there things that surprise you? Are there things that when you read the story, you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that, or that's really interesting the way that happened. And then the third is it a good story? Is it entertaining? Because again, I return time and time again, when I talk about these topics, to the point that just because something's old doesn't mean that it's good. And just because something's old doesn't mean that it's, it's horrendous,
Right.
Because that's another thing is that, oh, well, Victorian fiction, well, gosh, you know what that's going to be like. First page, it's going to be racism and sexism. And especially weird fiction, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Weird fiction, its focus is more on emergent horror, on like, where are we going as humanity? Mm-hmm. And so unfortunately, a lot of times they will turn to, racial or sexist or, just any sort of devaluation of human life. They'll use that as a metaphor, which is deeply unfortunate and disturbing. But what's interesting is, like, especially if you look at like the Victorian ghost story, most of the best Victorian ghost stories were written by women writers, and they tended to be women writers who were socially marginalized, because if you're writing for a living, something is probably a little bit off with your expectations during that time period. And so usually these are like single moms, women with drunks for husbands, women from families who are somehow socioeconomically disadvantaged, or single women who never married and need to like find a way to provide for themselves. So the ghost story is interesting, and that it is, now there's just societal things as far as race and gender that are going to just be part of that society, but the Victorian ghost story is uniquely interested in the stories of marginalized people and communities. So I do get some pushback on, classic horror, well, that, Lovecraft, that's what you're talking about. I haven't yet done a book on Lovecraft. I do think, I'm thinking about one that's maybe not going to be his quote unquote best stuff, but a subset of his work in the future. But I am really interested in how surprising Victorian Gothic literature can be, in that just because it is old doesn't mean it's innately evil or depraved or somehow anti-human. But yeah, it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I really like that you bring up the women writers of Victorian horror. I agree with you. I think some of the best horror fiction definitely comes from the women writing in this period. I think when I have my ideas of horror fiction and the stuff that I kind of write, I feel like I'm constantly coming back to them, because their voices are so very clear, and the criticism that they lay onto the world around them through the allegories they use in their fiction is wonderful. I think they're some of the best writers out there.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about how you annotate some of your work, because I know that you kind of blend a style of annotation. You'll have some that are just, kind of definition based, and then some that are a little bit more conjectural about, what do I think that this passage is really meaning, right? Yeah. Like, what's the subtext that maybe we're not talking about because of, the obscurity of the language, or the way that some of these writers kind of syntactically hide information from the reader that we're left to infer.
Yeah.
How, what, what does your process for annotation look like when you start, and what are some of the materials mm-hmm. that you utilize in order to build out those yeah. annotations for your readers?
Yeah, so I use a lot of databases and resources at like my local library. And then there's of course lots of books that I own that I'll pull out when I'm looking for materials to kind of clarify things that I don't personally know. The way that I go about that is I will, you know, pull up the story on Word, and I will just read through it. And anytime I run into a word, a term, a reference, or a piece of the story, you know, an element where it's like, oh, hey, there needs to be a signpost here to say this is a big deal, and this theme that is beginning right here, it's going to be important later on. Anything that pops out to me as something that maybe I might say like 14-year-old me would not know or would want to know more about, that's the audience that I'm writing to, is, you know, a 14-13-year-old you know, reader who's just running into this. And I know that the by and large the people who buy my books, it's not, you know, young teens, but just that kind of I don't want to make assumptions, you know, I don't want to assume what people know or don't know. And then as far as like, some of them are definitions, some of them are expanding on concepts. The reason I do that is because there's been books that I've bought before that are, you know, quote unquote annotated. Like there's in particular an edition of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea that I have, that there'll be like four pages at a time where there's not a single note. And then there'll be one footnote, and it'll just like be like, submarine. The submarine was invented, you know, in 1842, you know, or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, I mean, that's kind of interesting, but there were dozens of things over here that I would have loved to know more about, you know, but mm-hmm. you're just giving me the definitions and stuff. Or like, you know, definitely, I think back to, you know, in 2012, when I first came up with this idea, the two books that really, it's interesting, the two books that really gave me trouble, that inspired me to do this, one was Lovecraft. It was one of the Del Rey editions of, yeah. I think it was called like Blood-Curdling Masterpieces of the, or Tales of the Macabre or something like that.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then there was a collection of Ambrose Bierce, that was his best ghost stories by Dover. Mm. And both of them had like, I mean, the introduction to Lovecraft, I think it was August Derleth. So, you know, here's a guy who knows what he's talking about. But, you know, going through the stories, there were all these times where I'm like, wait a minute, I wish I knew more about this moment or about this, like, character, because there's something here. Like, I know there's something here, but I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
And then you'd look it up online, and in 2012, less so today, but in 2012, there just wasn't stuff online about these stories. Like, no one cared about them. Like, you look up,
yeah.
You know, maybe John Steinbeck or stories by F. Scott Fitzgerald, there's going to be stuff to that. But, like, these guys, you know, it's like, I don't know, just read the story. It's spooky. You know, it's a spooky story. You're chill. That's all there is to it. And yeah. So, I going through these stories, I just see kind of like, where's something that I would be annoyed, and maybe this is the biggest key, I would be annoyed if I was reading this story and a commentator didn't put a footnote to clarify a thing. So that's kind of the process that I go about. And then of course there's other like random stuff, like I try as best I can to do any currency conversion. As I mentioned before, it just drives me nuts when, well, you know, and he slipped him a half crown. Okay, what's that even mean? What is that in British currency? And then as an American reader,
is that like a tiara or something? Is
it... How many ducats to a florin yeah. over here? Yeah,
exactly. And then what is that today? You know, because right. like that's another thing is people will be like, well, a half crown, you know, half crown is 2.5 pence. Okay, what's yeah. that mean? And then I don't know what that is in American, and I also don't know what that is in 2022. Yeah. You know, so right, just right. little things like that, or references, like for instance, and one of the stories that I recommended for the next episode, they referenced the Crystal Palace. just like you should know what that is and you know what that means. What's the Crystal Palace? You know, so those sorts of things I like to, again, remove those barriers so folks who are reading it aren't going to be as like tripped up by it or annoyed, because honestly it's less like, oh, you got tripped up by that. It's less that, and it's more like, this is annoying because you're talking about stuff that I don't get, nor should I be expected to get.
Yeah.
See, now I don't feel so bad because Trevor made fun of me one day because I didn't know what pence was. Like a, it was like we were looking at like a payment for like an overseas magazine or something. And I'm like, oh, it says 5p. That's pence or that's pounds. And he's like, no, that's pence.
That's pence, bro.
And I'm like, and he's like, I'm like, I don't know British money.
That stuff can be super confusing.
I only give you shit because I'm British.
Yeah, I know you are. Yeah,
so like, my, you know, like, I don't know. There's some stuff in my lexicon that I know a little bit more about. I think it's really interesting your approach to, you know, annotation and just, you know, speaking to that, maybe that 14-year-old in all of us that you know, doesn't quite know some of this stuff. My approach when I read a lot of it, because I don't have critical editions that are, you know, this nice or this detailed. Most of the way that I encounter any of these Victorian stories are through, you know, like the big massive reprints that certain companies do. There's like a whole series, I think, that Barnes & Noble has put out with Fall River Press. It's just like the bonus box fiction, you know, this stuff that we can produce really, really cheaply and people will buy.
Like $8 hardcovers.
Yeah. But I think what frustrates me about those anthologies is like, for one, they're not very discerning about the quality of the stories that go in there. So I encounter, you know, like the Ghost Arms story was in one of those. That was just like, man, this felt like a huge waste of time. I don't even know, you know, what it was trying to allegorize. It was just kind of stupid and sensational. But they also do nothing to contextualize, you know, any of these stories. In some of those anthologies like Fall River Press, there's not even an introduction, you know, to any of the writers. You don't know who any of these people were. You don't know when they were writing, what country they were writing from. I mean, most of the time it's just like roll some dice. It's either US or UK, and most of them UK, right?
Yeah.
But I find it, you know, kind of frustrating that there aren't as many of these really well-written annotated editions. And I think that's also fed into some of the way that I read this material, because, you know, you mentioned like the Crystal Palace, and I, you know, that's something that I would just gloss over because I'm like, you know, that's, what does that contribute to the story? But I think, to your credit, when you annotate it, I think it adds depth, right? It gives us a depth of cultural reference that maybe alludes to some of the subtext that we might be missing. By not living in that moment,
it forces me to slow down, because Trevor and I have had this conversation. He's a consciously slow reader, so he can get as much as he wants. And me, through grad school and stuff, I just learned how to be a really fast reader. So when I have these annotated texts in front of me, I'm forced to slow down. I'll read like a passage and then I'll go back through it and I'll see where like you've listed your points. And so then I have to go back and reread the annotation and then reread the sentence where the annotation is like leading to. So it's forced me to, and I appreciate that because I'm getting a lot more, I feel like, out of the story.
So as we kind of like start closing out this episode, I just kind of want to throw out some fun questions out there.
Go for it.
What was like one of the first stories that you feel really like got you into horror, like got you into stuff?
There's no question. I'll have to think about that at all. Is The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. When I was here's another throwback to the late 80s and 90s. When I was maybe three years old, I was in daycare and they showed the 1946, I think it was 46, but the
Disney
Bing Crosby. Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Now, As an adult watching it, no problem. But like you look back, it's a scary.
I suppose the
final third of that movie is really scary. But I was just sucked into it. I loved it so much. I think what was so engaging about that story, and then I became obsessed with it. And Washington Irving is like, he's like one of my favorite writers. Mm-hmm. I just love Washington Irving. He's so funny, and he's very antithetical to a lot of the horror that I do also love and read and publish, because he's so sarcastic and snarky and fun and lovable. But yeah, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow totally sucked me in. It has this universe where there's these unspoken rules. Yes. Of what you do and don't do. And there's a community that fosters these rules.
Yes.
And they try to pass them on. And Ichabod Crane is a character that defies the community. Yep. You know, he's an interloper. He's essentially a colonizer of New England.
Yes.
Ethics. You know, he tries to colonize this Dutch community with, you know, who have a different approach to life and are less like cynical than him. And he tries to colonize them by, you know, hooking up with Katrina. And Brom Bones is essentially a hero. We usually look at him as a villain, but he's a hero.
Right.
He bites Ichabod off with
chases him off.
Their local lore. Yeah. And so, yeah, definitely Legend of Sleepy Hollow. I'm obsessed with it. And I did an anthology of Washington Irving's best ghost stories. Hands down, my favorite book to annotate.
You sold me. I'm going to have to go buy it.
Yeah, we got to go get that one.
I didn't even, until you brought it up, I didn't even know that I wanted to talk about Washington Irving or The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, because I think The Legends of Sleepy Hollow is that is a fine piece of literature right there.
It really is.
I think what's great is that, like, it does have the ghost story, you know, in a way, in a sense that people remember. But I also think it's way more politically aware of its moment, and people miss that. People think it's just about, you know, like the guy with the flaming pumpkin head and he throws it or whatever, and like that's not even the point. Like the whole point is Ichabod Crane's he's a jerk. He's a total jerk, and Washington Irving, I think, like, makes a caricature out of him almost with his weird face and his like huge nose. Yes.
Yeah.
And
he's kind of, he reminds me, I don't know if this is too deep in the weeds, but he reminds me of, I think his name's Malvolio in The Twelfth Night by Shakespeare, because he's this like preening social schemer who's so weird and creepy and over the top.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you dropped Malvolio, because my students are reading Twelfth Night right now, which is one of my favorite Shakespeare plays. You're blowing my mind. No, but I think that, Ichabod Crane is kind of like, he's the quintessential like British colonizer, right?
Yes,
like he is just like allegorically British imperialism.
Yes.
And the fact that he's so oblivious to the local customs and just like, like you say, kind of the ethical responsibility, I think, to observe these local customs and value them, right, is what makes him such a terrible person.
Dismissive.
He's so dismissive. He thinks he's so superior to everybody.
Exactly.
Thanks for bringing that up. That was...
no problem. That's my favorite story. I love it.
So are there any projects you're working on now that you want to share with us?
So I'm actually, it's kind of an offshoot. And part of this is because in September, I started doing this full time. I made this my full time gig.
Oh, wow.
And I stay home with my daughter. And so staying home with her is in some ways it's softening me up a little bit. And so as a little bit of an offshoot, I'm between horror projects right now. I'm kind of trying to decide which one I want to do next. But while I kind of decide this, I have started to cultivate a series of classic adventure novels. I've done Treasure Island. The Red Badge of Courage is what I'm wrapping up right now.
Okay.
And then after that, I'm looking at like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Robin Hood and Kidnapped and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool.
And this is a little less rigorous. It's still, they're going to be fully annotated, but these are a little bit more fun. And so
are you going to do your illustrations with them too? And
yes. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I want to include the illustrations, as well, but, so that's something that just, it's a little less, because adventure fiction is just genuinely a little bit more for the entertainment.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm working on. And, you know, if anyone has ideas, they're welcome to go to my website and email me, if there's like a specific horror writer that I should tackle next. But I just wrapped up M.R. James, and that was like a marathon because there's so much to M.R. James, especially when M.R. James is, he is the H.P. Lovecraft, not with the racism and stuff. I mean, obviously they're, you know, as a British man, a Cambridge man from the early 20th century, there's going to be some of that, but he's more the H.P. Lovecraft of England in the sense that he's just like so well known and so beloved. So working on him was a deep slog, and it was a lot of work. So I'm kind of taking a break, but I am open to ideas as far as who I tackle next. I'm kind of thinking maybe E.F. Benson, who's one of M.R. James' contemporaries.
I mean, that was going to
be the guy I tackle next.
That was going to be my suggestion would be
E.F. Benson. I love E.F. Benson.
Yeah.
He's a very interesting man.
Have you done Lafcadio Hearn yet?
I haven't, no, but that is a guy who's definitely on my radar. And I love his writing.
I mean, he was always interesting to me. Is he British or American? But he goes to Japan.
He's Irish.
He's Irish. That's right. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I believe, if I remember correctly, I think he's Irish.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, and he goes to Japan and just kind of adopts her. You know, of course, that's another kind of issue is this whole, not adoption of the, repackaging of the somebody else's culture, or this kind of, you know.
I do think that there's an interesting conversation to be had about appropriation.
Yeah, yeah.
And whether or not,
thank you, that's the word I was looking
whether
for.
Or not that representation is appropriation or not, you know, I think... How different is it from like what Neil Gaiman was doing with like his most recent Norse mythology, right?
Well, not just his Norse mythology, but also like not American Gods, but like Anansi Boys, where he's taking like this African and Caribbean kind of culture and mythology. And
I think, I think in a way, though, you know, there's some repackaging when it's done, I think, in order to open a door, right? Open a gateway. Yes. To a literature that we have ignored.
Yeah.
And I think that trying to make it a little bit more trendy for your audience to say, hey, there's a lot of stuff out there that's really, really interesting. You know, I feel like there is a need for that, right? There is a need for those cultural bridges that can bring us into these spaces with what is both familiar to us and very unfamiliar.
I feel like with Hearn,
so long as it acts as a bridge, right? Like the intention is not to be the authoritative source on these things, but rather the gateway to which we can then encounter the originals.
I feel like with Hearn, knowing his kind of a bit of his biography, I feel like he appropriated the culture in that he went over there and just kind of made it his own lifestyle. But then professionally, he's bringing us these stories that he's like open. He's doing like Trevor's saying, he's opening these doors that are like, here's this for the rest of the world.
Absolutely in love with Japanese culture. I mean, literally, you know, he married a local, he adopted the local customs and religion. You know, this Hearn is an individual who, he's not Kipling. He's not totally just adulterating another culture. Hearn definitely did it in a very respectful way, and I think he's a good example of that, of how to do that respectfully.
Yeah,
I agree.
So where can people find you to find out more about your upcoming projects?
I'm on, my website is oldstyletales.com. And I'm also on Instagram, Old Style Tales, or at Old Style Tales is my handle. And then other than that, I'm not on a lot of social media, but those are the two places that people can find me. So definitely, if you're more interested in the illustrations, there's tons of them posted at my Old Style Tales Instagram account. And then if you want to look at the books, and also I have a blog that I think is, I get tons of correspondence from folks who have run into a confusing story, and they found a blog post that I did about it. And that seems to be really helpful to people.
Cool.
So the blog, which is obviously linked to in my website, I would recommend that for someone who maybe wants to kind of dig into this stuff without having to buy a book, you know. Yeah. And then obviously that can be a gateway. If you find a particular story that you're really interested in, you might check out that book by that author.
Cool. Awesome. And I think we're following each other on Instagram. So
yes, we are.
I will, but we're also, we're on Twitter and some other things. So I think we'll share all your awesome posts and stuff on across
thank
the
you
board. So
yeah,
absolutely.
Very cool. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode. It was really, really awesome to speak with you, and you'll be returning for another episode, right? Where we talk about some short stories.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
Great talking, guys. You take care.
You too.